With Green Farm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Laura Fox for being such great company. It's Monday, the 22nd of March.
Coming up on Game On tonight, we look back at Ireland's thumping of England with Rory Best.
Here comes Keith Earls, gathers it now, races inside the 22-metre line, goes for the corner, Earls far side of the pitch, looks to touch it down, in for the try!
Conan Byrne reviews game week one of the League of Ireland.
There they are, the champions, Shamrock Rovers. They've broken their own record, their 18th title, their first since 2011, and the good times are back in Tala.
Stephen Kelly joins Conan to discuss Stephen Kenny's World Cup preparations, and we'll get his reaction to all the weekend action across the water.
Back to Tielemans. United back off, and Tielemans makes them pay.
And which of our show jumpers will be big in Japan? Brenda McArdle talks Tokyo.
Keane O'Connor is riding for gold for Ireland.
Three to go, Jess. Can they repeat the performance that you did in 2001? There's two to go. You can have one down.
They've got it. Phil, they've got it. They've got it.
They have
now. Got it. They've got it. Phil, they've got it. It's Ireland.
Ireland take the gold. And Ireland are the London FEI European jumping champions.
What a magic day that was. And you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Ruby, you made it back from Cheltenham. Successful week for you and for Ireland.
Yeah, it was, Marie, yeah. Not sure how successful a week it was for me. I didn't exactly have much to do other than tell lies on television, but I survived, yeah. We're back. It was a wonderful week and a great week for Irish racing, but it was a wonderful show, full stop. And even if you think, Marie, most of the people that were there were out of the country for more than 72 hours, so everyone had to be COVID tested again in Cheltenham on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. And you know, I think everyone go in COVID free, to come out COVID free for, and to have all the success they had. It was an incredible week.
What was the whole scenario and setup like? I mean, we're listening to the news now and it sounds very grim, just with COVID figures rising and, or at least not going the way, the direction that we want them to go in. But it seemed what happened over there was run off really well.
It was, but it was essentially split into, Cheltenham was a quarter of the entire racecourse, grounds, everything given to the Irish people. So what would be the best mate enclosure in the middle of the racecourse was basically where all the Irish stable staff were accommodated and where they ate, slept, sleep, drank, whatever else they were doing. And then the jockeys and trainers were in the Ellenborough Park Hotel, which is on the back of the racecourse, but can be entered and exited via internal roads. So once you checked into Cheltenham on Sunday evening and passed your COVID regulations, you didn't leave again until you were going home. So you were effectively in a bubble, and we were bubbled. And there was no contact with the English trainers. That's why I was even disconnected from the rest of the people at ITV I was working with, because I was part of the Irish bubble. I wasn't even in with them.
Upon reflection now, I feel like a lot has happened since Cheltenham finished, because we had the rugby at the weekend, but a lot happened in Cheltenham. Now that you've been home for a couple of days, looking back on it, what was the standout moment for you?
What was the standout moment for me? I don't think there was a moment that I went, oh my God. It just seemed to happen so often for the 4 days, and there was so much to be proud of and so much to admire. And I thought there were some great equine performances. I thought Honeysucker was brilliant, Alaho put the kettle on, battling back, Jack Kennedy winning on Manila Indo, I think Paul Townend just keeping going and getting a winner on the last day on Col Reavy. And then of course there was Rachel, and Rachel was the star of the show. But to me, if there was one, as a purist looking in, I would think the way Henry de Bromhead has developed and brought Honeysuckle's career to a height was training of a first class, was just first class.
Ruby, just on it, like you mentioned all that, but we don't chat about Willie Mullins all that much, because we just take it for granted that he's top trainer, isn't it? Like, there was incredible highlights, and you know, when everyone talks about it, you read the papers during the weekend, and Willie probably, just for me looking back at it, you think, is he getting enough attention for what he does?
I think we were leaving on Friday evening. I was travelling with Willie's assistant trainer David Casey, and before we left, we met Willie at the hotel, and we were kind of laughing, in a sense, even me being part of that team, we felt a little deflated, even though there were six winners. It was just the expectation, and with the horses that we had or he had, and what you were hoping they could achieve, some of them didn't perform. I mean, you were hoping Albin Photo could win the Third Gold Cup. You were hoping Shaquem Pourceau could win the Champion Chase. You know, small things, Concertista getting beat in O's or short head in the Mayor's Hurdle. There was a couple of results. There was a lot of seconds. And the difference between first and second in any sport is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, are we kicking on with rugby, guys? Brilliant stuff. Yeah, Ruby, we were chatting about it. I was saying to you that the important thing around rugby was watching Cheltenham coming into these massive matches and just seeing the dominance of Irish people doing so well. We'll move on to the rugby, and we're delighted to be joined by Ulster, British and Irish line, and with 124 caps for our country. Rory Best, how are you?
I'm good, Donald, thanks.
He's not going to get that wrong again, Rory.
No, I won't.
No, he's not.
Bestie, how good was Saturday's performance?
Oh, it was brilliant. I think the way they dominated from the word go, and I think the start of the game, like, England were in it, you know, it was a very close game at the start, but you just always felt watching it that if Ireland could just get ahead of them and get away from them, that it was going to be hard for England to come back into it, and it's really good for them to all the little things that they'll feel a bit working on, and they'll have felt very defensive throughout this championship and sort of say it's not too far away, it's close, and their only words unless you can actually produce the performance, and in fairness to them, they did that on Saturday.
Rory, it was a nervy start though. We've seen players running into touch. But one man that set the way was Robbie Henshaw. I just thought that the first 15 minutes, when everyone looked a bit rudderless, he was the fella showing the way for the team.
Yeah, he has been the last, right throughout the championship, really. But even after that Scotland game, where they needed him to be a bit more direct, he was really direct. And then the same against England, and he's playing. Robbie's a class player, and really since 2017 Lions tour, he's been dogged a bit with injury to get that rhythm of playing games in a row, and I think he's really benefited from that now, and he's of that kind of that age bracket, that kind of 27 to 30 where you're in the form of your life, you're in those peak years to perform, you've got a bit of experience, you've still got a bit of youthful exuberance on your side, and he certainly is really cracking on and was brilliant again on Saturday.
Yeah. Sorry, Ruby.
No, go on, Dunica. I prefer listening to you and Rory now talking rugby to me.
No, not at all. But just, Rory, we're an Autumn Nations Cup in a Six Nations Cup or Six Nations Championship. Where are we now under Andy Farrell, from your view, looking in at it? Have we transitioned a team? Have we transitioned a game plan? You know, have we moved on since Joe?
I think that there's certainly, in terms of the team, there's been quite a few new caps. He's tried a few different combinations through the Autumn Nations Cup than the Six Nations. So I think he probably knows where his depth is. In terms of transitioning as a team and the way they're playing, I think we saw a lot of that. This group now have got to bring that consistency. You know, it's no longer a transition period where, you know, we're trying to tinker with a few things. They've now shown what they're capable of. Because they hadn't really shown a performance like that. They'd shown it in bits and pieces, but not a full 80 minutes. So that is now their benchmark. That's where they're going to have to get to. And I think that it'll be interesting to see. There was a similar fixture in 2017 where Ireland were playing England and England were going for back-to-back Grand Slam. So they were in a slightly different place. But Ireland went into that Six Nations game, fancied and had lost to Scotland first up there, lost to Wales in their second last game, and produced a big performance where that was almost, I remember being in the changing room afterwards talking about how this was, that has got to be our benchmark, but everything is, it doesn't drop below that, and I hope that the squad now, and that was really the catalyst to go on to win, to do well in the Autumn, then a Grand Slam, then the Autumn 18 that everyone knows about, and I hope that this group really go on to kick on and get that consistency.
Rory, look, there was magic moments that resulted in some of the Irish tries, but to me, and I've kind of pointed the finger a little bit here all along about leadership, but Johnny Sexton stood up to every penalty and kept the scoreboard ticking, and it just kept huge pressure on the English.
It did, because obviously it made Ireland buoyant. It just kept moving ahead of them, and England then, you and England have been really bad this tournament, giving away penalties, and they became under immense pressure because they knew that anything in their own half, Ireland were going to have a go at. Ireland had been putting a lot in the corner, but on Saturday they took a lot more on for that 3 points, and Johnny never looked like missing. And when you're on that team and you're in, from an Irish point of view, it's brilliant. From an English point of view, it just puts you in the back foot because you know you can't concede penalties, and when you do, it almost just becomes, it's like death by a thousand cuts. You know, it's just constant. And I think Johnny again has been somebody that's been, he's been talked about as being under a little bit of pressure, but I think that probably the way the team hasn't been as consistent as he'd like has put a bit of pressure on him, because I think he's been really good throughout this tournament. I think they missed him badly against France, and in this run of Italy, Scotland, England, he's shown different aspects of a game that are really on point at the minute.
And Rory, just looking to the future, like, what do you do now? Because it's like his good form is nearly a blessing and a curse, because it's brilliant having him in that form, but at the same time, he's 35 and you know he's not going to have that forever. Do you start to now maybe look at trying to bring somebody in and try and start that transition, or do you keep going as long as you possibly can with him?
I think you got to play him in the big games as long as you can. I think the beauty they have now, and it's a pity there isn't some more games, or we didn't know there was definitely going to be a summer tour or whatever, because when Johnny gets in form, that's when you can actually start to have a look at playing other people, maybe put him on the bench, maybe not playing him at all. I think part of the problem that Ireland had in sort of 19 and 20 was that Johnny had a couple of little niggles. He was missing Leinster games and was back for Ireland games, and they need to play him into form, but he's in great form now. So it does give Ireland, Leinster, the luxury that, you know, you can play them a little bit more sparingly, because it's, when you're in that sort of rhythm, if you miss a game, it's never ideal, but it's okay because your confidence is going. And for Johnny, it is, as much as anything, it's about the confidence to know that he can sort of throw these passes, make these kicks. And I hope now that they play him enough to keep him in this form, but they also use the time to make sure they mind him with the future in mind, the immediate future, but also then the long-term future, is who's going to sort of help transition.
Rory, as a fan, you can't not mention a few moments of magic. Jack Conan in the line-out, the Keith Earls in the step for the first try, Hugo Keenan's catch from Johnny's up and under that resulted in Jack Conan's try. Bits of magic are wonderful for fans, and I really enjoyed those.
They were, and like, when you're playing England, the big moments that you really, there, what turned the game. That, to get that try was an incredible bit of play from Jack Conan. It's obviously something they looked at, that Tom Curry chases hard, but England want to defend hard in the line-out, so they chased in. Jack Conan, how he got them, when I was watching it in real time, I thought it must have ricocheted off somebody, because it sort of looked like it was just a bit of luck. But Jack, in fairness, was lovely soft hands, and Earlsy, it just shows you, when you give Earlsy a little bit of room and a bit of space, and he doesn't have to constantly be this workhorse, that he just shows his class. And to turn Johnny May like that is no mean feat, and it was an unbelievable finish. But those moments were happening all over the place. I think that sort of the scrum penalty on 60 Minutes, when I know that Tadhg Furlong's become a social media sensation these days with all his celebrations and his sidesteps and bits and pieces. But, you know, it showed England had the scrum, it was a free kick, they went for the scrum again, because I think that they felt that they could get a penalty and get into the Irish half, and for Ireland to turn that round and get a penalty, you saw what it meant to Tadhg. And when some of your key players who have played in big games are showing that, everyone else follows. It was another 3 points, like we've just talked about, and those sort of moments, and the key players really stepped up for Ireland.
I saw Mike Ross tweet actually just after that he loved scrums, and I had a good chuckle at it. But what is it about Ireland's scrum that's really working right now?
I think they've just had a little bit of time together, and they have a lot of weight coming through from the second row. John Fogarty has them really buying into what they're doing. They've altered a little bit from the autumn as to where the number 8 his position. You know, he's no longer trying to hold the second rows back. He's trying to get himself into a position where he can fire people in. And I think the great thing about the Irish scrum historically has been when you give the back five of the scrum, your second rows and your back row, when you give them pointers and tips and, you know, you give them something to really buy into, they work incredibly hard for you. And as a front row, you know that. And it's just to make sure that they're on the same page and that they're given little tactical nuances to help the front row, because they give you everything they have, and it's just about channeling that. And John Fogarty, just like a lot of the other coaches that have come in, just you always need a little bit of bedding in time, a little bit of time for the players to trust you, and a little bit of time for what you're working on to come to fruition, which has really been the last 2 weeks. They've had a couple of big scrums that have got them some big penalties.
Donica, we've spoken quite a bit about Tadhg Beirne over the Six Nations, and just now where we are and taking a minute, where do you think he should be played regularly?
Yeah, it's difficult for me. I think he's a brilliant six. I think he's a really, really good six. I think, but that's when you have someone like James Ryan and Ian Henderson in the second row. But I'd like that to be a competitive place. I just think Ian Henderson is playing his best rugby. He really is. I think I think he's our starting second row, to be completely honest, for me at the moment. So I think he's offering so much. Rory mentioned it there, but having scrummage in second rows, I think too much is made of Tadhg's size, to be honest, which it's all about the power he probably generates. And Rory, you probably played with him a bit more to know about that. You know, could he go in behind the tight head and lock it out? But I'll be honest with you, Marie, he's one of these fellas, just get him on the pitch. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Munster use him this week, because you know, you can play him, I think he's at Lions level at both at six and in the second row, which is quite annoying because it's hard to play one of them.
Rory, I'm a fully fledged member of the Bundiaki fan club, and whilst I thought Peter O'Mahony had no complaints, I felt a bit sorry for Bundy at the weekend. Was it definitely a red?
I felt sorry for him as well, because there had been absolutely no malice in it, and to get the red after the World Cup again, having got his chance. I think the problem he has is that Billy Vunipola doesn't change height the whole way in, and it's, you know, I think when somebody dips late on you and you hit him there, you're unfortunate. I think when he comes at that height, you gotta know where he's at, and you gotta technically judge that. The only interesting thing that I would see would be if Billy Vunipola comes at that height and Bundy goes to hit him exactly the way he did, and Billy, who he does quite regularly, steamrollers him and goes over the top of him. You know, that's just play on. So it's kind of, there was a bit of a point made in the studio on Saturday, and they said, yeah, obviously you can't hit him there. He hasn't changed height, so it's a red card. And if somebody made the point, we're going, well, like, okay, if he doesn't change height, where do you tackle him? And someone like Billy, that's the hard bit, is where exactly do you get him to hit him hard enough to get him to stop? But ultimately, the fact that he didn't change, as a tackler, you've got to take the responsibility to change your technique a little bit to attempt to tackle him without hitting him on the head, which is, it was a pity for Bundy, but those are being reffed really, really hot at the minute.
I know we want to move on, Rory, so one last one. Just Earlsey's try, you mentioned that there was brilliant by Rob Herring and Jack Connell, and then Earlsey to gas Johnny May was incredible. But that must be a massive lift for Mike Catt and his attack to score off launch like that.
Yeah, it's a massive lift for everyone, because when you get Mike Catt, you want to score off first phase, because all your analysis and all your homework, it shows that it works. From a player's point of view, it's the easiest thing to do. You know, the boys in the line-out, you know, you throw the ball in and the next thing you're looking up and Earlsey scoring. There's nothing gives you a bigger lift. So for these guys, those little moments, it just makes all the planning and the hard work in front of a computer all worthwhile.
We're tight on time, Rory, but it'd be wrong not to chat probably about one of the greatest games of rugby we've seen, Wales-France, and for it to be taken from their clutches in the last minute into extra time, you'd nearly have to feel for the Welsh.
Yeah, it nearly would, wouldn't it?
only France only had 14 men, so how would you be feeling for them?
it's an interesting one, because actually I was sort of there going, oh, you know what, I'm not really that good. And then it panned to someone like Alan Wynne-Jones, and it did. As a captain, go going to lift your second Grand Slam, thinking you have it done and dusted, and to be taken away from you, it was an incredible game to watch. But they threw it away. Their discipline went to pot with sort of 10, 20 minutes to go. France also tried to ruin themselves as well. And what a game of rugby, and what a finish. And yeah, like, I think you'd be gutted if you're Wales. You'd think you'd thrown it away. But ultimately, France, if you give them chances like that, ironically, they probably played their best rugby when they're down to 14, which would be very French.
Yeah, definitely. So, just your opinion, Ruby asked a question about Johnny Sexton, but did you think it was a bit of a mistake taking off Dan Biggar when you just need to control a game? I know he's a fantastic talent, Callum Sheedy, but just to finish that game out, I think Biggar would have done a great job.
Oh, totally. I think that they've obviously been making that change throughout. And at the start of the tournament, Dan Biggar, I think, was struggling a little bit, but in the last two or three games, he's really found his form. And the other thing, he gives you that incredible kicking game, but the other thing he does unbelievably well is he kick chases and catches really well, and like that can get you ball into the opposition half, and that's what you need. I think Wales were just a little, even in 78 minutes, they had a knock-on advantage, which they then tried to play the 2 minutes out, and really what they should have done was go, you know what, we'll actually take the scrum, because you can mess around long enough and waste 2 minutes on a scrum and then just kick the ball out. And they just had a couple of real malfunctions. So they had the same against Ireland. So that game won, and then they kicked the ball back to Ireland with about 20 seconds to go. You know, so there is a little bit of tactical naivety, and sometimes with Wayne Pivac coming in and the way he wants to play, which is full throttle, is you lose a little bit of that tactics, and then when you take somebody as smart as Dan Biggar off, it's probably exaggerated a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Rory, it really was a super Saturday. Thanks for taking us through it. We'll take a quick break and we're back to chat soccer.
Game on 2FM. With Green Fern. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, there was a huge amount of football over the weekend, and there is a huge week of football to come as well. And I'm going to start with the League of Ireland opening weekend, and I'm delighted to say that Conan Byrne joins us. Conan, I'm not sure what was a bigger surprise, the fact that Shamrock Rovers, Dundalk and Bowes didn't win, or the fact that the two teams that most people were predicting would go down, Drogheda and Longford, both got wins.
Very surprising, Marie. Absolutely. The only team in the Premier Division that finished in the Premier Division last year that won a game was actually Finn Harps, who finished in eighth place. So, very surprising weekend in terms of the results. Especially, as you mentioned there, Longford's win at Derry. I think everyone was suspecting Longford to be in around the bottom. Probably still will, being totally honest. But Derry are a very young side, still gelling together, and Declan Devine will have his work cut out up at the Ryan McBride Stadium this season. But terrific results for the so-called lesser teams, like the Finn Harps beating Bohemians, Longford beating Derry, and of course the magnificent win for Drogheda at home to Waterford.
Yeah, there was definitely some interesting results, but I think the Dundalk Sligo one I thought was a very entertaining game, and it was actually great to have all these games on over the weekend and be able to watch them. But the name that we spoke about actually on Thursday in our preview was Johnny Kenny, and he had a great game for Sligo, only a teenager, and he just looked right at home at that level.
He's the one to watch, I think, Marie, this season. He scored 5 goals in pre-season. As I said, he's only 17 years of age, and Liam Buckley, over the years, he does put young players into the mix. I can remember back to the likes of Jamie McGrath, Chris Forrester, when they were both with Pats, just throwing them in, see how they got on, and look how far they've gone with their career. So I'm expecting a similar kind of story here for Johnny Kenny. Led the line terrifically well, brought others into play, the hold up play that I suppose Liam loves in his sides, and it was an all round good performance from such a young player at only 17.
Dundalk were just, I suppose, trying to see the old and the new come together. I don't think they're quite there yet, just in terms of their performance, and also when you take into account that there is a lot going on behind the scenes as well. How did you think they did?
Yeah, look, it's going to take some time for them to gel with all the new signings that they've made. I'm really impressed with Jarkowski at right back, filling in instead of, obviously, with the loss of Sean Gannon to Shamrock Rovers. But yeah, it's going to take some time. All in all, I think they were lucky enough to get a point at the Showgrounds, because I thought Sligo did deserve the 3 points on the night, especially with their second half display. But I'd be still taking encouragement from the fact that they went up to Tala and got a great result up there for the President's Cup the week before and won the game on penalties. But yeah, I think Dundalk will be fine. Off the pitch stuff is still a bit worrying, I suppose, with the who's the manager, who's not the manager scenario in the dugout and how that's going to play out. The players, I'm sure, are going to be a bit distracted by that too. Who do they listen to when the advice comes from the sidelines? And yeah, I've no doubt about it. Dundalk will be fine. They'll be up there come the end of the season.
Did you think when St. Pat's got their noses in front with 2 minutes to go that they'd hold Rovers out? Could you see Rovers getting that goal back?
I couldn't really know, because obviously it was like a snatch and grab. Well, it should have been a snatch and grab victory for St. Pat's. I thought they were absolutely superb the whole game. Their press from the front, they didn't really allow Shamrock Rovers to play out from the back. Forrester, as I mentioned earlier on, he looks like the player of old. He was brilliant. He was running around, and he hadn't been doing that over the last number of seasons since he's come back. So he's got his fitness back. He's got his will, his desire to play, and that was great to see. So when they did take the lead, I didn't see Shamrock Rovers scoring, but I suppose you're always vulnerable when you do score, and against a team like Shamrock Rovers, you have to be switched on. I think the loss of Paddy Barrett in the last couple of minutes, I think it was cramp more so than anything else. And a great ball in by Sean Horan, but a magnificent finish from Aaron Green, who came off the bench and scored on the opening day of the season, similar to last season as well.
I actually thought when Aaron Green came on, I said, he's going to get a goal now. He looked someone that was very determined. Look, I think in the lead up to the game, there was a lot of talk about how Shamrock Rovers were going to replace Aaron McInniff and Jack Byrne. How do you think that they coped in the St. Pat's game?
Look, when you're going to lose the likes of Jack Byrne and Aaron McInniff, no matter who you are, you're not going to be as good as you were. I think that they brought in Chris McCann, they put Ronan Finn, who was operating as a right wing back last season, they put him back to his more natural position, the central midfield. The only concern that I'd have with that is that they're both in their 30s now, and they don't probably have the legs like the likes of Aaron would have had last season. Aaron as a box-to-box midfield, a very, very creative player, and they don't have that this season. I know Ronan will be still very, very fit. Chris, I love his style of play. He gets on the ball, plays it, does it simple. He reminds me of Steve McPhail when he came back to the league a couple of years ago. And yeah, I just think it's going to take time for them to settle with Danny Mandroyo as well, coming in from Bohemians. I don't think he's lit the world on fire since his move up to Tala, but that time will come. I think he's going to be a shining star for Shamrock Rovers. And look, he'll want to be if they want to retain the title.
I really enjoyed Ollie Horgan's comments after the Finn Harps and Bowes game. Just as you'd expect, talking up Bowes despite his team having a very impressive victory.
Yeah, well, Ollie Horgan still probably thinks he's going to be relegated by 15 points, but that's Ollie Horgan's style, and he gets the best out of his players, and they really they play for him more so than any other team in the league. I think they really, really G's up his players. Now, having said that, Bowes absolutely dominated that game, and I really don't know how they didn't go in at half time 2 or 3 nil up. They never had that goal problem though that Bohemians have had. Like, Bohemians have scored goals over the last number of years, especially last year with the three lads up front, Chris Fardick, Danny Grant and Andre Wright. Losing all those three players, Marie, at the end of one particular season is going to be very difficult, and bringing in Georgie Kelly, the Donegal player, the Donegal native, I suppose, that went back up to Ballybuffet in the hope of scoring a couple of goals, didn't work out. And then obviously as well, they have young Dawson Devoy, who's going to be a star called up into Jim Crawford's under 21 squad this week as well. So no, as I said, Bowes will be okay. It's just that I'd be worried in terms of the goals that they scored last year. Will they get the same this year? And if they don't, obviously they won't be up as far as they did.
Yeah, I think it just takes a little bit of time for everybody to settle into it, and we are only 1 week in. Now, the Republic of Ireland, their game against Serbia, I think it's actually just creeped up upon us because there's been so much happening over the last week with the rugby and with Cheltenham, but it is an absolutely massive game for Stephen Kenny. Stephen Kelly now, former Republic of Ireland player, joins us on the line as well. And Stephen, unfortunately, we're in a situation where we are still talking about injuries and absenteeisms because Stephen Kenny's look just doesn't seem to be changing.
No, it really isn't. The amount of withdrawals he's had for injury in key players, key positions,
senior players, it's been a bit of a travesty since he's taken over, and luck has not definitely not been on his side. But you know, when it comes into the game, you need to just put these to the side and pick the best team you possibly can from the players he has. And it's never an easy situation to be in, and with COVID as well, that's caused so many issues. But at the moment, he's not had an easy time at all.
So Stephen, like watching those players and the arriving at the training ground yesterday and then today heading on the plane for Serbia, and obviously we're all just sitting at home here lamenting the fact that there's so many high profile players that are not able to take part. But if you're a player in that situation, are you going, okay, forget about all of that, this is a massive opportunity for me as a player and for my country as well to try and start off on the right foot in these World Cup qualifiers?
Oh, absolutely. And like, it's one thing from a manager's point of view, because he has his ideal 11 that he wants to play, and majority, a lot of them are not fit. But as a player coming into the squad, your first time being called up, or it's an opportunity to play in a game that you might not have started because of an injury, it's a huge chance for you to go and make a name for yourself and prove yourself at this level. So yeah, you got to take these opportunities. You got to realise that these don't come around that often, and it is a really tough game. It's not going to be easy against probably second favourites in the group. So going away from home, but you've got nothing to lose, and you really have to be on your top of your game and willing to basically get through it just to try and make an impression.
Conan, I've been listening to people trying to call a starting 11, and it just seems absolutely impossible these days because there's so much change as nearly every day passes by, and Premier League games and FA Cup games and all are happening. But what do you think, or where do you think that Stephen Kenny has the biggest selection dilemmas?
I think up front, Marie, I think like with the likes of Callum Robinson, Aaron Connolly, you have Shane Long, James Collins and Troy Parrott. Who do you play? They've played 104 appearances in the league this season between them, and they've only scored 14 goals. And four of those have been by Premier League, like two with Callum Robinson and two by Aaron Connolly in the Premier League. Like, put into context, Dominic Calvert-Lewin has played 25 games this season and scored 14 goals. That's one player. I think there's a big problem up front, and we've talked about it already. So who are you going to select to score those goals for us? And I really don't know. Like, I know Aaron Connolly is working extremely hard to be fit. Fit for the game by all accounts. I think if he's fit, Maria, I think he has to play. And who do you play up alongside him with the goals that we are lacking even in domestic form? Obviously, Mark Travers is going to get the nod up front, in goal. He's with Bournemouth. Obviously, he had a bit of a long spell at Swindon where he played a couple of games and done particularly well. So I think the attacking areas is where Stephen is going to have the biggest headache.
But Stephen Kelly, does Stephen Kenny not just go to Serbia and think, right, damage imitation, get a point out of this first game and move on? Is he going to be that worried about who's playing up front?
I think whoever plays up front is going to be set up in a system that their attributes can cause them problems, but they can also get back and press from the front and have energetic so that they feel, even if I know, we're not the most prolific, that's going without say, but you want to have players in the field that if you're a defender playing against these guys, you feel like they're a threat in behind or they can cause you problems. So players with pace, the likes of Connolly, if he's fit, even Shane Long, he's pacey, he's quick, he wins headers, he's not prolific, but he offers something different. So it's a tough ask from the manager, but and damage imitation is the one thing, but if you go out setting up just to sit back and defend, the inevitable will happen and they'll score. You have to have a counter-attack or an option to go up front as well to pose a threat.
And Conan, I think probably another issue is the fact that we have been talking so much about Stephen's philosophy and the way that he wants the Republic of Ireland to play. Now, obviously, they haven't got the results up until now, but there is going to be pressure on to come out and start winning games and start scoring goals.
Absolutely, like, and the performance levels have been very, very good, and it's just been so frustrating that he actually hasn't had the break, I suppose, up front in the players scoring the goals. And add to that as well, the loss of form by some players, like Shane Duffy's loss of form has been incredible. Even Matt Doherty at Spurs, he had a terrible game last week, and Mourinho dropped him completely from the squad. So what's his confidence going to be like going out to Serbia? And when you look, like Jason Knight as well, we're going to be probably relying on a 20-year-old midfielder to do most of the running. And if he starts, he's played 37 games as a 20-year-old in the Championship at Derby. He's had a phenomenal season. I just hope he takes that, I suppose, that confidence that he's got from Wayne Rooney and the players around him at Derby into the international setup. But as I said, he's only 20 years old. And then the new Serbia manager, Dragan Stojkovic,
leaving out the likes of Alexander Kolarov and Luka Milivojevic of Crystal Palace just goes to show the depth of their squad compared to our own.
Yeah, and sometimes when there's a new manager as well, you can get a bounce. But Stephen, when players are heading into camp, and you've obviously been there, so you know, what's more important to a manager? How they're training in the days up to the game, or the minutes that they're getting back with their clubs?
It's going for Ireland for a long time now. It's going to be based on how he feels down training. Minutes in clubs is great, and every manager goes in with a philosophy. Stephen Kenny did. He wanted players in form. That was a lot of his remit, was like, I want players that are playing for the club. But that goes out the window when the majority of squad are not playing all the time, or they're playing at a lower level to what some of the players are getting less minutes at. So what's going to be based on is when they come in, who's showing energy levels, who's showing confidence on the ball, who's showing willing to take it in situations, players. And then it's going to be players that have been there and done that. And I know that's easy to say, but a reliance on players that have been in the situation before, played international level, know what's at stake and know what it takes to get a win, is going to be heavily reliant on experience as well. And I know that's not what everybody wants. You know, you want to give new blood, but sometimes situations like this, that they need it.
Is that Shane Duffy, do you think, then, Stephen?
Yeah, I can't see. He's not going to play. Shane is, I think, regardless of his form at the moment, we can't really afford not to play him. I think Stephen thinks he can't afford not to play him. I think the likes of Darragh O'Shea is doing well. Clark is playing at club level as well, week in, week out, at a very high level. So, yeah, granted, these both guys are in a relegation battle. So defensively, they've not been in amazing sides this season. But I don't think he's going to go without Shane Duffy.
So who's your back four then?
I think he will go O'Shea, Duffy, Coleman and Stevens.
Coleman, what system would you play?
I suppose the $1 million question, isn't it? Like, because you don't know what Stephen Kenny, the way his philosophy is, he's kind of started, he liked to play the 3-5-2 formation and try and keep it tight at the back. Whether he does that against Derby on Wednesday, I don't know. Yeah, I think he might go 3-5-2. If not, I'd probably agree with Stephen, you play four at the back. He might even play just one up front. So, I'd love to be in Stephen's head at the moment to be able to tell you that, but it's just, you just don't know what way he's going to set up, especially with the players at the moment that are available to him. I think that's going to be come into his mindset as well. I look at Jeff Hendrick, who's not playing at Newcastle. Does he play him, given the amount of experience that he has at international level? And obviously he's going to rely on his new head coach and youth first team coach, Anthony Barty. He's just after coming in now as Chelsea first team coach, so by all accounts his influence has been very impressive on the players so far, and they've really bought into him, so I'm sure Stephen's going to rely on him for advice as well.
It's just going to be pretty awkward, isn't it? They're going to need 4 points out of the two games this week, so I don't know. I'm glad I'm not in Stephen Kenny's shoes. That's all I know.
Oh, absolutely. It's so hard, isn't it? Like, we need to get off to a good start in this campaign, and you just kind of feel like this is whatever that's going on. The players, but I think you go with a five. I think that's you get Matt Doherty. I know he's not playing well at club. You get him in a right wing back position. You get Edna Stevens in a left wing back position, and you get Coleman in beside the centre backs to give that bit of pace. But you start Seamus because I think he's a driving force in the team with his attitude and the way he implements himself. So
you have to start Seamus, yeah.
Have to start him there.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to see what he goes with from what he has. It should make for an interesting view. Anyway, Conan, thanks so much for joining us. Stephen, we're going to keep you, if you don't mind, because we want to turn our attention to the football across the water, because there was a plenty of it. And we're here talking about team selection and the importance of team selection. And I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer found out over the weekend how important it is to pick the right players. Now, he did defend his choices after the game and said that he needed to rotate them and that he would do the same again. But do you think that he made the right calls?
This is why we question Ollie every time. Every time he gets himself to a point where you think, oh, you know what? And then he does something like this. And it's like, why would you do that? Why would you do that? It's an international break coming up. I understand players are tired, play a lot of games. But when you have Shaw, who's been his most influential player, apart from Fernandez, you don't play him, you don't play Fernandez, and then you bring them on to try and win the game. It doesn't make sense to me to change players. It's an FA Cup. It's an opportunity to get a trophy for Manchester United, who are a team who need trophies to be successful. And for me, it's a missed opportunity. And it's again, this is why he's going to get questioned throughout his whole United career, because there's always a point where he makes a decision and it seems tactically he gets it wrong really badly every now and again.
I mean, like, he could have been facing Southampton in the semi-final. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it really is. And like I said, for a diehard United fan, they must be pulling their hair out. Like, they just,
oh, we are, trust me. We are.
I know, a new contract and everything on the table, and then something like this happened, you're like going, what? The thought process just doesn't seem like it's there. You're kind of thinking, what would really make you think that this is the right idea? I don't understand it, and, you know, it's a massive missed opportunity.
It was a missed opportunity as well, I think, for Donny van de Beek, just because there were so many people calling to get him on the pitch in the last few months just to see what he was capable of. But he just doesn't seem like he's at that level. But yet, you know, we saw what he was, how good he was when he was in Ajax. Is he just not working hard enough?
It's so hard to know. You know, you don't know whether he's completely deflated, his confidence is gone. You know, we always expect players to arrive in the UK and just hit the ground running and have no issues with settling into the environment and thing, and that's part of it. But for him, it's not working out for him. It really isn't. And no matter what he seems to do, lack of game time doesn't help. If you're playing week in, week out, sometimes you can play yourself out of a rut, but he's not getting that opportunity. Thrown in a big game, and then the pressure's on him, and then the question marks come again. So his confidence got to be very low, but it's only going to improve by playing games, and the manager doesn't seem to trust him enough, so you can't see it rectifying itself.
Stephen, were you impressed with Leicester? I know everyone's on about the format, changing two now up front, but defensively they're strong.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's something that you take. I think for United to have done what they did against Leicester, who are a team who are in form and a very good side, they cause teams problems. They score loads of goals. They're very good in the attacking front. Defensively, they're solid. They looked really strong. So it's not like you're putting out a side against a weakened team. In Leicester are a very good side. They're up near the top of the table for a reason. Everybody's questioned whether they fade away or not, but you know, Leicester were excellent and the goals they scored, granted a lot of them are United's own downfall, some dreadful decisions, and I know Fred is getting a lot of stick for that one, but I think Maguire was equally as culpable for that goal. He just kick it away. You're creating no difference passing the ball to Fred that 5 yards out.
But Vardy could have scored before that anyway. That was only a compounded error. It was from what I was watching, it was pretty much a one-sided game anyway.
Oh, it was, yeah. Leicester controlled the Vardy when he skipped past Maguire, and you just expected him back in there. He hit the side netting. They could have had 4 or 5.
Textbook Manchester City performance against Everton. I don't think they really set the whole pitch alight, but they just do everything, the simple things, so well.
Yeah, and it's just, they're so clinical, aren't they? And their passing can be so crisp at times. The defence, they had a couple of chances. Zinchenko cleared one off the line from a header from Mina, which was a good defensive position for them. But they just look so good on the ball. And when they pass it crisply and they move forward in the waves that they do, they're such a good side. They're going to be so hard to beat. And, you know, this quadruple, you know, we talk about it and you dare not say it as if, but it really is on the cards. It really is.
When can we start talking about that, Stephen?
Now. Let's talk about it now.
What about the ruthless side of it, though, Stephen? Not putting Aguero out again, an unused sub.
I know. It's unbelievable to think that this guy, like Guardiola, for some reason, he's never really been in love with Aguero, even though Aguero has been an unbelievable, if not one of the best foreign imports to the Premier League in the history of the competition. So, but for some reason, Pep has never really shown him that much love, and he's always had to fight really hard for his place. But to think about, he's not playing now. I think he still has an important role to play for this team at some point in this season, and there's no better person to rely on coming into the business end where you need someone to pop up in a moment of brilliance or a goal out of nothing. To still have him in your back pocket is unbelievable.
I wonder, will he use him though? I don't know, is he just at this stage just nearly making a point that he doesn't even need him? So if anybody did miss the semi-final draw, Leicester are playing Southampton and Chelsea are playing Manchester City, and those games are on in the middle of April. I think the game of the weekend anyway, the one that really got everybody off their seat, was West Ham United and Arsenal. 3-3 all after West Ham going 3 goals ahead early in the first half. It couldn't have been any more Arsenal, really.
Oh, no. West Ham were so good as well. They tore them apart. And then Arsenal defensively were just really, really poor. The goals they conceded, the quick free kick was just sinful. You can't completely switch off and give a goal away like that. But then to be able to come back in and show the character that they did, the goals, fortunate for two of them, deflection, our own goals, and West Ham unlucky not to put it to bed in the end. But it was a great, great game to watch for a neutral Arsenal. There was so many defensive penalties and just the ability to switch off, which is really costing them.
And Stephen, Spurs were 2-0 winners over Villa, but Villa without Grealish is like United without Fernandes and Shaw.
It's even worse. It's funny because I had this conversation with someone about Grealish, and what he does on the pitch is exceptional. He really is. He is a special, special talent. I said it before. I trained with Aston Villa for like 8 months when I was getting back from my Achilles, and I trained him week in, week out, and I didn't really appreciate how good he was, so I trained him, and I was blown away. He is such a special talent. He's unbelievable. In saying that, it not only is it what he does on the pitch, it's the psychology of it. Like, if you're in a side and you have a player that good and he's out, sometimes you feel like you can't win my helmet, even though you probably could. You have something, it gets into you that, oh, he's not there. We're a man down, we're a few men down without this guy on the pitch. You have to get over that. You have to be able to win without someone like that in your team to be able to progress as a team. And for Villa, they seem to be really, really struggling with the fact that when he's not there, even though he's exceptional, he creates so much for them, but the team themselves are suffering mentally, I think, from the fact that he's not there.
And just on Harry Kane, because the conversation is really intensifying about what he should do, which probably means that Mourinho and the job that he's doing isn't what anyone expected it to be. But what do you think he should do now? Should he move? Should he stay? What would you do if you're in his shoes?
I know you want to say what I would want to do, but because I'm a Spurs fan, I don't want him to go. But he's got to be considering. He has to be considering leaving. He really has to be. Unless Spurs go out this summer and go, right, I tell you what, here we go. Here are all the players that we feel that you can improve you and win you a medal. We're going to go and just do something we've never done before and break the bank, go help a ladder, just throw money at it and bring in everybody we know we need that to catch up with the teams that are so far ahead of us, which Tottenham won't do. Then he's got to be saying to them, these are my cards. I need to go win something. I don't know whether he will or not. He's a diehard Tottenham fan. He loves being at the club. He plays for them. He does anything for Tottenham. But with his ambition, he's captain of England. He's got to want to win stuff. And I don't know whether it's going to be enough just to be breaking all the records at Tottenham. I think to go through his career and not finish with a medal, it'd be a catastrophe.
Yeah, it was an interesting conversation on Talk Sport actually late last week about which career would you prefer? Would you prefer to be Harry Kane or John O'Shea with all the trophies? I don't know what the answer was, but that's probably a conversation for another day. Stephen Kelly, thanks so much for joining us. We will have the Ireland-Serbia game live on Game on Wednesday night, and Stephen Kelly will be with us. We're going to take a very quick break and then it's show jumping.
With Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We're going to talk show jumping very, very shortly. But first, Ruby, Cheltenham Gold Cup winning trainer Tom Taff has decided to end his training career after 27 years.
Yeah, and I read somewhere earlier, Marie, that I rode his first winner for him. I didn't think I actually did, and a horse called Drumineer. That was down to one in Killarney, but I think I won on it in Navan. But that'll be stand to be corrected. But he had a great career, but like everything, clients move on, investors move on, and that's what trainers need, is clients and investors. And you know, Tom's clients, things changed in the, I suppose, almost 10 years ago for him, and he's decided to take the big step and try something different.
Tough business, no doubt. Okay, it is time to turn our attention to show jumping, and Brendan McArdle joins us now. Brendan, a good weekend for the Irish show jumping team in Florida.
Yes, Marie, the Irish, a large contingent of the Irish team are down in Florida. They're really there since the first week in January. And this weekend, Dara Kenny, he won the big three-star Grand Prix there last night with Great Tika Zed. That one sponsored by Horseware Ireland in Dundalk. There was 45 starters in it. But also in the class as well was Max Watchman from Tipperary. He's just 17 years old and he took seventh place with Lazaro. But meanwhile in California, Nicky Galligan, he won the four-star All-Star Grand Prix there with Java's Miss Jordan. So the Irish have really been doing really well in Florida and in the States over the past couple of months.
Brendan, they're the lucky ones that are, not the lucky ones, they're the guys that are in Florida, and ladies as well, but obviously those in Central Europe, they're still at a bit of a loose end with the EHV virus. It's all still closed down across Central Europe, is it?
It is, Ruby, yeah, and they've been making sort of big changes there sort of to try and keep the circuit going. They've closed everything down really in Valencia, also in Spain and down in Portugal. But it looks like the FEI have put systems in place and that the international circuit will get up and running soon enough, because we have the likes of Dennis Lynch, Mark McCauley all here or in Europe that are competing, and they'll also be looking for team selection, hopefully for the Olympic Games.
I'm looking at the Longines World Rankings, Brendan. We have so many riders in the top 50 in the world. Dara Kenny, Dennis Lynch, Shane Sweetman, Paul O'Shea, Daniel Coyne, Shane Breen. Like, we have a show jumping team qualify for the Olympics. It could be a very strong one.
It could. Michael Blake's in Florida at the moment. He's the Irish team manager. Yeah, this is a big week out there because it's the big Rolex 500. So it's $500,000 in the Grand Prix on Saturday evening. He'll be looking at all the contenders that he has out there, because he has Bertram Allen, who's went out. He has David Blake, his own son. He's got Michael Duffy from Galway. Dennis Lynch won't be there. But Shane Sweetham, who won one of the five-star. Keane O'Connor has PSG final back in action, but he won't be jumping him in the five-star. He'll be jumping a horse called Kilkenny, which he thinks an awful lot of. And then you have the likes of Dara Kenny there as well. Like, so he'll get a really good understanding of the horses, what they're capable of. But it's a long road between now and hopefully getting to the Olympic Games. And Michael Blake will make that decision probably after St. Gallen, which is around the 17th of June, whenever that Nation Cups take place. So he'll have seen some of the horses jump in America. He'll have seen other team combinations jumping in Europe, and then he'll make up his mind.
And Brendan, his team selection, is that based on points or just on who he thinks is the best horse in form at the time?
The best horse in form, possibly not on the on the time, Ruby, but has shown maybe a bit of consistency, and that maybe can peak whenever he comes to getting to Tokyo. That's what it's all about, because sometimes if you look at some of the combinations that have went in the past, they haven't always been winning around Europe and winning the Grand Prix, but whenever they got to the Olympic Games, then they were able to peak and deliver them clear rounds. And that's really what Michael Blake and Team Ireland is all about, is getting that Olympic medal, and they have a really, really good chance. But with the whole circuit in turmoil, and everything, not knowing whether Olympic Games is going to take place, preparation is difficult, as it is for every athlete. But I think what the Irish show jumping team can really take on board is that they're getting a lot of rounds practice in Florida and some of them other shows in Europe as well.
And just if we look here at home, what about the Dublin Horse Show, just taking into consideration how difficult it is to organise big competitions and big events?
Yeah, like last year it didn't take place, and it was a big hole in the whole circuit for it not to happen. Thankfully, equestrian sport can happen now in Ireland, so they could run a show at Dublin behind closed doors. Whether it'll be for the nationals or whether it'll have international participation, we don't know that yet. That'll be up to the equestrian committee at the RDS, and also ultimately the board of the RDS, because there'll be huge financial strains on them to run an international show to the standard that the FEI would want them, and to also be able to have an Aga Khan and to have a Grand Prix. Whether they have the same prize money or not, that's another thing, but it would certainly need to, people here would like to see it happen, the international circuit would love to see it happen, and it'll be up to the RDS board if they can make it happen.
Brendan, would it be an alternative from maybe running it somewhere other than the RDS with the year that's in it? I mean, its location in Ballsbridge, it's more than just an equestrian event. Would they move it elsewhere for the year that's in it?
They could possibly, Ruby. I think what they are doing at the moment is they're certainly making plans that the qualifiers for all the young horse classes will take place. So they've been in touch with the likes of Show Jump in Ireland to make it happen. Like, they could hold some classes at different venues around the country, have it behind closed doors, because at the weekend Mullingar was on, Cavan was on. There's plenty of show venues on, but it's to have them all coming together and run one big championship. So that's what they'd really like to do.
Okay, well, it is a case of watch this space then. Brendan McArdle of the Irish Field, thanks so much for joining us. That is all we have time for this evening. Tara Stewart is up next.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.